Welcome to the podcast, everybody. This week we have Rob Cesternino of Survivor fame and now a podcast giant. You know him from his podcast. Rob has a podcast and also a two-time Survivor participant. Hey, Rob, welcome to the show.
Paul, thank you.
Thanks for being on. We hung out a few months ago when I was on with you, and we were on with Tio, which was kind of cool, and I thought he was going to be like the Tio you saw on TV, kind of a dick, but he was really nice and frankly kind of a pussy.
Yeah, he's a really nice guy in person. He's really, you know, I think he puts on more of a persona when, you know, he was in front of like all of the, you know, the world and, you know, yeah. Of this is, hey, I'm the, you know, the baddest man, you know, but he's much more of a down-to-earth, you know, nice guy in real life.
Yeah, well, when I heard that he was going to be on, and I expected to walk into the studio and see him lying on the floor doing crunches with a shirt as a way to get his fee up from the Sideshow Network for working there. Yeah, remember when he did that when he played for the Eagles in a driveway? What an idiot.
So he was holding out, and he was like, you know, showing off, like having like a mini camp and showing what good shape he was in.
Right.
Yeah. We don't see that as much in today's NFL.
No, I think we need more of that. Well, now you see Johnny Manziel on a giant swan swigging a bottle of champagne, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, he's like doing crunches on a stripper somewhere.
Yeah, but I expect that's what I want. Like, you're 21 years old. What did you do when you were 21? If you had access to that kind of fame and money, you think you'd be, you know, keep your nose clean? I'd be, you know, banging hookers two at a time and leaving a couple of them dead on a roadside.
Well, that's like the whole thing with Bieber, and, you know, he's doing all this crazy stuff. But I always say, like, thank God nobody was following me around. No paparazzi was following me around when I was 20.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. I was driving in my mother's Oldsmobile in Providence, Rhode Island, where I grew up. And you grew up in New York, in Long Island, right?
Right.
And this is how careless we were. I was 17 years old with my buddies drinking a case of Budweiser cans. And I'm done with my can. What do? I roll the window down and I throw the can out the window. And a cop stops me and he gives me a ticket for littering. And that was it.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think this whole thing is, look, as long as nobody's getting hurt, you know, it's, you know, I basically want to be the guy that works for the NFL as like a, you know, they always have a guy like who's a cleaner, you know, they come in and clean up messes. I want to be that guy. And I just want to be the guy that sits in the limo as we're going and say to them, okay, tonight, you don't shoot anybody. You don't kill anybody. And you don't kill or shoot anybody.
Yeah, but if you're the cleaner, you're the guy that's got to come in when there's like, you know, the dead body in the locker room.
Exactly. So it might even
be you're going to Aaron Hernandez's house.
Right, exactly. Listen, after you shoot a guy, don't walk back into your house with a gun in your hand and blood on you. Because you have cameras, asshole. Unbelievable.
What if you break the camera then?
Yeah, well, you know, because it would have been too much work. He would have had to get a small stepladder. And, you know, he had things to do. He had blood and crypt tattoos to have put on his testicles.
So. I think he broke his phone. I think that's what he did after the fact.
Right. Yeah, exactly. They'll never get anything out of this. He's the kind of guy who thinks if you turn the computer off, all the information goes away.
Yeah, right.
And then the sad thing is the two guys that he allegedly killed before that they think led to Odin Lloyd getting killed because Lloyd knew. Basically, they just spilled a drink on him. But, you know, so if he had just worn some kind of a outerwear that was water repellent, this would never have happened.
It really is so crazy, the whole Aaron Hernandez thing, where the guy is like becoming like this emerging superstar in the league, and he just can't stay away from, you know, getting involved with, you know, whacking people.
Well, I mean, listen, I'm a comedian, and I do that a lot on the road, but I leave
whack
it on
people?
The road.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, sometimes you have a good set and it goes to your head, and the next thing you know, somebody gives you the wrong look. And no, I think, you know, the problem is that these guys have so many yes men around them that nobody, you know, if you're not going to tell anybody, if nobody at the Patriots knows what you're doing, certainly nobody in your family is going to tell you because for sure you're going to cut them off, right?
Yeah.
And by the way, who knew Bristol, Connecticut was a hotbed of gang activity? Really? I thought basically what Bristol, Connecticut has is one Greek pizzeria that serves grinders.
Yeah.
And by the way, for those listeners who don't know what a grinder is, it's a hero sandwich. And if you don't know what a hero sandwich is, get the fuck out of America. Okay? So I want to turn to your background because it's fascinating. And, you know, you were a guy basically working for an insurance company, if yeah. I have that correct, kind of, you know, regular job, regular Joe, living in New York. You went to college here and decided, watching Survivor and decided, you know what, I'm going to give that a shot. What was that something you had always, this is back around 2000, early 2000s, 2002, 2003, when kind of Survivor was the reality show and the reality genre had really sort of started to get hot. And was that something you always had in the back of your mind wanting to do?
Yeah, so I grew up and I always just wanted to work in TV. I wanted to be a game show host. And I sort of said, you know, I'm going to go to college and I'm going to study broadcasting. I went to a state school in New York and I just would have gone anywhere because I was so excited to go away to college. And so
State University of New York at Oswego, and that's upstate. It's beautiful up there.
It's beautiful up there for like 3 months out of the year, and then the rest of the time it's like, you know, the ice planet Hoth. It's very, right. It's very, right. Very. You know, it's they have a winter up there.
Right. Well, you were really immersed in it because you wrote your senior thesis on the impact of reality television.
Yeah.
And, so you got an A.
I did.
Good for you. I'm proud of you, young man.
Thank you. And I got really into the whole reality TV thing. But I graduated from school and I didn't have any idea how do you go from having a degree in broadcasting to actually having a job. I had no plan.
So tell me, there's a couple of things here. Were there certain game shows or game show hosts that you really thought were great and you kind of wanted to emulate?
Yeah, Price is Right. That was my jam. I was really like from the time I was like, you know, four all the way through when, you know, Bob Barker hung it up. That was my show.
And what was it about game shows that really captured your fancy, as they say?
I don't know. It was just always really exciting. I don't know what it was. Like, I wasn't like a normal kid, like watching cartoons and stuff like that. I was, you know, watching like Family Feud and The Price is Right and, you know, all of these other things that were on in the morning when I was like a little kid. And I think my parents were just happy that they could entertain me with just keeping the TV on and Card Sharks and all sorts of things like that.
So by the time you were five, you basically had like perfectly coiffed hair, a suit and tie, and a long, thin microphone, and you'll say, I'll have waffles today.
Yeah, I'm basically like I'm making game shows in my house and like trying to get like my, you know, my sister to, you know, guess how much this can of string beans costs and stuff like that.
Oh, that's great.
And
that's
if you can imagine, Paul, I didn't have a lot of friends.
Yeah. Yeah, I would imagine that that's a party of one right there.
Right.
And did you... But then your interest shifted to reality shows. Because when you were little, there were really no reality shows. Now we're so I guess by the time you're in high school, that's when they kind of catch
your eye. It was college. It was actually when I was a senior in college was the first season of Survivor. And I had watched like The Real World and stuff like that. But Survivor was a reality show, but it's also a game show. And so that's really what the appeal to me was of like, wait, so you can win the show by, you know, you have to be the last person to not vote people or last person not voted off. And it's like over 13 weeks. And so I got really wrapped up in this idea, as most of the country did at that point in time.
And when did the shift go from, now at this point you get your degree and you're thinking, I want to go to, I guess, Hollywood or New York and try to
produce. There was no plan like that. It was like I graduated and I'm like, boy, I don't know anybody who's going to give me a job. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to commute to the city every day. So I had a family friend that had an insurance company and he was like, hey, do you want, like, you're good with computers. Do you want to come work in my office? And I was like, sure. I mean, that's better than anything else I have going on right now. So that's just how I got started on that path.
Right.
And I was like, this job is boring. Like, I should probably go on a reality show. And then once I do that, then somebody will realize that I'm entertaining, and then somebody will give me a job.
That's good. You know what? It's great when you're young, that you just think like in a clear path like that and have no sense of like how kind of crazy that thinking is.
And I'm like, oh, I'll meet women, and so and then yeah. I'll get a girlfriend or I'll get laid, and then this will be good.
Right. It's funny because I just interviewed Gilbert Gottfried for my podcast last night, and he said that very same thing. He basically dropped out of school at 15 to be a comedian, and he's like, yeah, you know, and I just thought, wow, I want to be a comedian. It'd be fun to be on TV because like all those people I see on TV, and I thought that seems pretty easy. And he goes, you know, at the time, who knew? Like that's when you're young, there's that sort of innocence about you that. But I think that's a good thing. Otherwise, it would keep people from pursuing their dream and achieving great things if they let sort of logic get in their way, you know?
Yeah, if you knew about all the things that sucked about that idea or any career, you would never get into it. It's sort of like, you know, that's what sort of like keeps the people who make it in it, because there's this whole long drawn out period where it sucks. And that sort of like keeps all of the people who aren't going to be the pros out of it.
Right. What was the first thing that hit you when you came into, no pun intended, the reality of being in reality TV or being in TV or part of the entertainment business where you go, oh, this is not what I thought it was, and it kind of sucks. Like, was there a moment where something hit you like, ugh, this is not as romantic as I thought, perhaps?
Well, you know, the thing that kind of sucked about the reality show is sort of like how abruptly it ends. So I actually had like a period of like a 2-year period where it was really just like nonstop with the reality show. I applied to be on Big Brother because I basically felt like, you know, I'm way too much of a pussy to actually go on Survivor. So right. I said, well, let me make a tape for Big Brother because that's just sitting around a house. And right. So I made a tape for Big Brother and I went through that whole casting process, and I actually got extremely close to being on Big Brother, that they thought I was funny. And I said I was going to, you know, have sex with all of the women in the house. And
yeah. What do you do? You just make a tape to camera? And what did you say? What was your pitch?
I made a tape and I sort of was talking about, I made it like I was being interviewed by the host the day after I won. And I was talking about how, oh, I had this strategy and I got all the women to be sexually interested in me. And the, you know, the off camera voice that was pretending to be the host was like, that's funny, Rob, because we didn't really pick up on that any of the women in the house were interested in you. As, oh, yes, they were. You didn't see that, but they were all. And so, you know, and that was, you know, my character, that, you know, I'm the, you know, loser that wants to get these women and none of the women really want anything to do with him. And so they thought I was funny, but they ultimately went with somebody else. And then a couple months later, out of the blue, I got a phone call from the casting agent of Survivor and said, hey, do you want to be on Survivor? And I was like, okay, sure, whatever. But
so when you're doing these, and this is what I'm fascinated about, I want to get a peek behind this, and it's for my listeners as well. You're not just presenting, oh, here's my headshot, here's what I look like, and I'm a good looking guy and I speak well, put me on. You kind of have to be your own writer, director in putting together your pitch, your audition, right? I mean, which is different. Like, you know, I act and you get the casting director sends you what they call sides or a few pages from the script, and you go in and you read the script. The character's been drawn up and written and you execute, but you kind of got to be do all of those things, and you had to do that for Survivor. So how do you do that? Do you study the show and see what they don't have and try to fill that void?
Well, the advice I give to people, it's almost like when you start being a stand-up and you're sort of like coming up with what your comic persona is. So basically, you have to sort of like establish what that voice is of your comic character, and then how do you see the world through that, you know, unique personality that you have and what you bring to the stage? And I didn't really realize it in those terms at the time, but you sort of like get feedback from the producers when, you know, you're doing things that they like. Oh, yeah. So then you just give them more and more of what they seem to be excited about. And for me, it was, you know, I had a casting producer that anytime I talked about how I was going to, you know, I was so horny and I was gonna, you know, I was gonna have to, you know, I was gonna, you know, get this girl and I was gonna flip the couch over in the Big Brother house so I could hook up and, you know, like anybody's hooking up with me in the Big Brother house. But they loved that stuff and they really ate it up. And I lived at home with my parents and I was like, okay, well, this is great because I'll have more privacy living in the Big Brother house than I do in my parents' basement. And so they, you know, that sort of, you know, the, you know, 24-year-old, you know, loser that is, you know, desperate for these women, they like that character. And so I just, you know, kept giving them more of it.
Is it the kind of thing that once you lock yourself into that character, you kind of, you know, week after week, you don't want to be that person anymore?
No, because, I mean, I wasn't like living a lie. Like, I am that person or was that person. But
yeah, you got to say was now. You're married with a kid.
Yeah. in some ways, I'm more that person now. But, you know, you sort of like, it's an embellished version of me. And I'm sure, like, you know, plenty of comedians that are, you know, their onstage persona is similar to what they are in real life, but more of a, you know, in real life, they're a lot more muted than they are, you know, in that comic character that they play.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And so you're on Survivor now, and that is kind of a, you kind of had this reputation of being not just the horny guy, but kind of that guy that would make alliances and then switch and double-crossing people. So you're the horny double-crosser.
Well, that's a, people's kind of like, I was 24 at the time and people thought I was just sort of like, okay, well, he's like the nice, funny guy. But I was really playing the game very hard because I was a super fan of the show. And I sort of really had the strategy down to a science more than a lot of the other people that were, had barely seen the show that I was playing with.
What I've always wondered is there a general strategy that generally gets people to win, or is there no such thing? And if there is, what is that sort of general strategy in your opinion?
Well, I think that the most general strategy I could give you for playing Survivor is just don't be an asshole to everybody. And, you know, just keep everybody really, really liking you, but sort of like be open to what's going on. And if you have to switch from the group that you're with to, you know, go with a different group, then, you know, you just have to be, you know, mindful of what everybody else is doing. Like, there's not one strategy that's always going to win. It's sort of like, you know, the battle between, you know, if it was, you know, well, what's a team that wins the Super Bowl? Well, you could have sometimes that you have a good offense, sometimes you have a good defense or whatever. So it's always different what wins, but really just the social skills is really the number one thing.
And the social skills, meaning basically it's like, the Godfather, keep your friends close and your enemies closer, right?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. You know, you don't want to like alienate people, and you want to be have a good relationship with everybody. Even if you don't like somebody, you want to make them think that you do like them, and sort of keep them in the inner circle. It's, I mean, it really is a fascinating game. And it, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish.
It's a fascinating game, and because it's such it. Emulates all of these other situations that we're in, whether you have
In real life, you mean?
In real life. If you work in an office, you know, that's the same thing as Survivor. Or, you know, you're on a, you know, a sports team, or, you know, all these different places where you have these complex group dynamic relationships where somebody's the leader and there's always like backbiting and people going behind each other's backs. And anytime you're in a group of people, there's the same kind of things happening like happened in Survivor. And you know people that are like the people on the show. So it's a very relatable show. And everybody that watches Survivor thinks about, well, if I was on the show, I would do blah, blah, blah. And you don't feel that way if you're watching, you know, CSI. You don't say like, well, if I was investigating the case, I would do blah, blah, you know.
Well, that's a good point. Survivor, I guess, working in an office is like a 30-year version of Survivor, right?
Yeah.
You're trying to get to be the top guy and you have to be Machiavellian at times.
People are screwing you over. Right. Going behind your back.
Was there ever a strategy that you put into effect on either of these shows, or that backfired, or it turned out not to be the right way to go? And what was it?
Sure. There was definitely the second time I played where I didn't go as far, but there was definitely things that I did that sort of blew up in my face. Notably, there was a girl who really hated my guts, and I thought I could sort of get back in her good graces, and I sort of... we had had like a big celebration where we had gotten very drunk, and I was kind of hungover the next day. And while I was, you know, hungover, I had this idea of like this whole big plan. I was going to take this girl that hated me all the way to the end. And so I sort of like approached her with this idea, and she's like, you know, how do I know you're not lying to me? I'm like, no, trust me. This is good. I'm going to go. We're going to go all the way to the end. And I sort of had told her like, well, and I want to go to the end with you because I think that nobody likes you and I think I can beat you. And again, this was not my finest hour because I was a little hungover. And then shortly thereafter, she sort of like went back to everybody and blew up my spot in front of the whole group and said, oh, Rob told me he's going to go to the end with me and he's going to vote all you guys out. And I was really caught in a bad situation. And I was sort of like, no. Like that, like I was making that up to tell you. That was a fake story I told you. And I was lucky that everybody sort of believes what I was saying, but that was not such a great deal. You don't want to give people that, you know, could hurt you any ammo to, you know, do something like that to you and sort of like blow something up in front of everybody. That's called the Donald Sterling. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you ended up coming in third on that show. What do you think kept you from winning?
Well, the way that it worked was everybody had, you know, been really respected the game that I had played. Even though I made a lot of people mad, I think everybody could tell how hard I was playing. And so they have like the little contests of who gets, one person gets immune from the vote. And so my thing was that we had to stand on like this like very narrow pedestal. And we had to hold something over our head. And the girl that I was up against, that same girl that I told, you know, nobody wants you to win and you should go to the end with me, she ended up winning that last challenge. And then she got to pick who she wanted to sit with. And she took the other guy who was there, who really had no idea what was going on most of the game. And then she beat him and ultimately won the game.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And how did your life must have changed from that, right? What was things like after that for you?
Well, it certainly some things changed and some things didn't really change. I think in my head, I thought things were going to be way different than they ultimately were. I mean, the biggest thing that came out of it was that I ended up meeting the person that would go on to be my wife at that time, that my parents would have like a big party every week. We lived on Long Island, so they would have like 40, 50 people over every week to watch the show. Because it was like, hey, you know, our son is on TV, so come in and watch him every week. So my sister, one of her friends would come over every week, and then finally, that there was, you know, a woman that was interested in me. I had to go on TV for this to happen, but I thought that there was going to be a lot of women that were going to be interested in me, and that really was not the case. I really just found one, and so. Ultimately, then I ended up marrying her because, I thought it was going to be like, you know, a nonstop party. And I don't want to make it sound like I don't love my wife, but I definitely thought that there was going to be a lot more. But it's probably a good thing, you know, to have, you know, find one good one as opposed to like a bunch of random skanks.
Yeah. How is it your son? You have a son, Dominic, and he's born in September, I believe. So he's almost coming up 7 months or so. How is it having a little kid?
It is very fun, but it's also a big challenge because I work out of the house also. I started as a full-time podcaster at the beginning of this year. So I'm home all day with the wife and the baby. And so that is definitely presents a lot of problems because I work a lot. So I'm in the house, but I'm also, you know, working almost all the time. So I get a lot of, well, you're still working. What are you doing? What are you doing in there? Why do I have to watch the baby all the time? So it's tough, but it is, you know, he's starting to get to the point where he's starting to actually be like an actual person and not just like, a screaming, like living thing that is just in our house.
Right. When you were on, after Survivor, you went on Survivor All-Stars. Mm-hmm. And what did you pursuit? Was that a different strategy for you? And in terms of pursuing, because now you had already revealed your game, right? So you had to probably change up
what your approach. Well, now you're really onto something here, Paul, because what happened was that Survivor All-Stars was really very soon after I had done the previous show. And, you know, the previous show that I didn't win, but my game was very celebrated. And Jeff Probst said, oh, this guy, Rob, he's the smartest player that never won. So I got sort of tagged with that. And then when I came back in the All-Stars against all of the best players at the time, then it was sort of like, well, yeah, we'll see how smart this guy is. And they basically, I got blindsided at the first chance that they had and just said, well, get rid of this guy. And so,
because they knew your rep and they knew your game, and they just said, we want this guy out of the box. But you couldn't see that coming because you had to expect other people were going to do a bait and switch on, right? Like everybody, you knew everybody else's game too, right?
Yeah, it's a fair question. I thought that my idea was coming into the second game, I'm just going to keep my nose clean and I'm going to keep my nose clean and I'm not going to, you know, give anybody a reason to, you know, think I'm doing anything suspicious. And I did just that, but it didn't matter that they still just got rid of me. So in hindsight, I probably should have been like, you know, just going from, you know, the starting gun of trying as much as I could. But, you know, hindsight is 20/20. And back to your earlier question of what was, you know, the most difficult part of all of this, you know, after going to do the show the second time, I sort of in my head thought, okay, I'm going to go do Survivor All-Stars now, and then I'm going to be famous. And then I'm, you know, the world is going to be my oyster after this. And I didn't do well. And after that, it was sort of like, okay, well, we're done with you now. Please go away. And the hard part for me was, okay, but now what do I do with the rest of my life? You know, I had this plan.
Yeah, I mean, is that the... Go ahead, you had this plan.
I had this plan, and now it didn't work. You know, I said...
Well, it was the problem that... And I don't mean this to be disparaging to you, but look, I'm guilty of it too. Everybody goes into show business, especially as performers, because you want fame. But if you just want fame and you don't have a particular art or skill, not to say you don't have that, but like, you know, when you're doing reality TV, it's basically you're not creating a play or whatever. That becomes a slippery slope in some way, right? For this very reason that you say, like, when that ends, that door closes, you've got to have something to fall back on, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's totally a fair point. And I think it's something that really messes up a lot of people where, you know, you get that fame and, you know, they always say this about the reality TV people where it's like, you know, you have enough fame to, you know, get recognized in Burger King, but you don't have enough money to not be eating at Burger King. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. And so you get fame and then you sort of then get cut loose. And it's like, well, now what do I do with this? And it's sort of like, well, I don't want to go back to going to work in the insurance office. You know, I feel like I, you know, got to see this other, you know, side of things. And I really wanted to continue to, you know, to pursue what I was going to do. And I just really did. I really didn't know how. But in my particular case, like I didn't really want to be famous in that, like, I didn't really want to be like an actor or something like that, or, you know, just be famous. Like I wanted to work in some form in the entertainment industry. I'd gone to school for broadcasting and, you know, I wanted to do something. And so I ended up the summer, I was very depressed at this point in time. And I ended up having somebody reach out to me in LA who was running a production company and who was wanting to do stuff with former reality people. And he was building like a website where, you know, following the lives of like reality TV people afterwards. And I ended up, you know, starting to work very closely with this producer. And ultimately, you know, a few months after Survivor All-Stars, he was like, hey, you got to move out to LA and come work at my production company. And so that's ultimately what I ended up doing and moving across the country to go work at a production company. And that was sort of my introduction to Los Angeles.
Did you have some money saved up from the Survivor. I would imagine you might miss some money, and so you're able to live off of that. But it's interesting because I do think that the culture is about being famous, and you know, especially with Twitter and social media now and all that, like people can use that as a springboard to be famous or feel famous through it. And we're a culture that's really kind of obsessed with fame, and reality TV gives you that, but it is this sort of drug that eventually you've got to wean yourself off of, or you're just going to be looking for the next fix. And you know, at some point, you know, you're going to be, you know, there's no door to knock on anymore. And did you contemplate going, you know, on an Amazing Race or some of these other ones, or are you kind
no,
of like,
there was
are
no
you at that
interest.
Point, are you, is the sort of, is there a sort of within that part of the business, a unwritten rule that if you've been on a couple of high profile reality shows, you can't do others? How does that work?
Well, in the CBS show, it's gotten, you know, increasingly incestuous, where they've, you know, they've taken somebody who was the winner of Big Brother and put them on Survivor. And, you know, now there's, you know, there's always been people from Survivor going on The Amazing Race and people from Big Brother going on The Amazing Race. So the CBS shows have gotten very incestuous. But as far as for me personally, after I did Survivor All-Stars, nobody wanted me anymore. You know, it was not like I had a choice of like, oh, I think I'm going to go on this show now and pursue this. It was like, you know, really, it was like, okay, we're done with you. You know, go on with the rest of your life. And I, that was what was hard for me of, I didn't know, you know, where I was going to go. But, you know, I was lucky that I was able to, you know, find a job, you know, working in entertainment where I was very happy with that, to go just to make the leap from working in insurance to working at a production company.
And people should know, you review every week, you do post-show recaps of, you started doing reality shows because obviously your passion and your experience on them, but you also now branched out to other shows like Game of Thrones and other scripted television shows. What do you find to be the state of reality TV? Because my friend worked at MTV and was a person who developed Real World. And that was, I remember at the time, oh my God, it's so inappropriate and it's too invasive and blah, blah, blah. And then it just became, you know. And then Survivor came out and that created buzz. And was a at times a slightly polarizing show in terms of, you know, what should be on TV, and you know, and then that to me seems to pale by comparison to how far things go now in reality TV. With you know, I'm Italian, I can say this, but these crazy Italian broads flipping tables over and punching each other out.
Right?
Have you noticed the game keeps changing and the odds, the stakes are higher in reality TV? You think it's going down a road that's bad, or how do you feel about that?
Well, you know, this is something that I've sort of, you know, studied from, you know, all the way back through the 90s with the Real World and all the way through the evolution of Survivor. And, you know, like anything in our society over the last 15, 20 years, you know, our attention span is getting shorter. And it's harder and harder to rise above the noise. You know, there used to be, you know, whatever, you know, even when you had cable, you had like, okay, I have, you know, 50 channels and I don't have a, you know, Twitter and a phone and all these, you know, a million other things and an app and an iPad open at the same time. And you could sort of like, you know, watch what was going on a show. And it was like it could be a slower pace. If you went back and watched Survivor from the first season, it's extremely slow. And you would think it was boring. You'd say, how has this show, you know, become a big phenomenon? But it was. And now everything is just, you know, you got to get into it, the faster pace. And it's like on the first episode, we're making alliances and talking about everything. And that's Survivor, which is probably the classier of these shows. On the other side of things, where it's like, you know, the Kardashians world and all these other Tori Spelling and Housewives shows, it's like if somebody isn't, you know, they're doing something, you know, sexual, scatological, cursing, hair pulling or whatever, people aren't going to tune in. So the stuff that you need to do to sort of like make a splash keeps, you know, the stakes just keep getting higher. And I don't know if at some point if we have to have like a snuff film or people, you know, all these naked shows, you know.
Well, you know, you look at Honey Boo Boo, you look at, you know, that's unsettling to a lot of people because there's a feeling that that girl is just being, you know, essentially, you know, taken advantage of by her parents.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe that's true. I don't know. But the part of the problem that I have is if it's going to be a reality show, make it a fucking reality show. Don't do this semi-scripted docuseries bullshit like Duck Dynasty. It is so clear. Those guys can't stop laughing through the bits that they've been told to do.
Yeah.
And it's so transparent that it's unwatchable. And I don't know if that's the reaction you get from people, because I guess you monitor this stuff a lot more than I do. But do you agree with that? I mean, if it's going to be reality, just drop the camera in and make it. I understand that look, I work in TV and you got to make stuff happen sometimes. But how do you feel about that? Do you feel that's gone too far? I guess the genie's out of the bottle, though, right?
Well, you know, a couple of things. You know, I don't really follow the, you know, Duck Dynasties or Kardashians of the world. That,
well, you
know,
you're crazy, man. You should be. Where are your priorities?
Well, I mean, the things that I focus on the podcast that I do are sort of the competition reality shows. So basically, right, the shows that involve strategy and are a game. So the stuff that's sort of like the, you know, faux reality, that's the sort of stuff that I walk in the room when my wife is watching. I'm like, oh, really? We're watching. What is this about? What are they working a, you know, a tanning salon? That stuff, it's cheap and it's just sort of, you know, in some ways, it's just, you know, it's lazy production where it's like, it's a scripted show, but you don't have to actually, you know, write a script or pay writers or sort of work it out. But I mean, those are the things that, you know, they're popular, and people just sit there and, you know, on a Saturday will watch, you know, 8 hours of that stuff. And, you know, you didn't learn anything. It's just a bunch of stuff happened and you just sort of experienced it. And there's really not too much to take away from it.
Yeah. I just don't see it. I just think, you know, the only way it changes if people stop watching it, you know what I mean? And I don't know that that's the case, you know, because it's definitely kind of that, some of those shows are like car wrecks that you can't turn away from, you know. How difficult has it been for you as a reviewer? Has that been like something that came naturally to you? And like, what are you reviewing lately, or what have you seen lately that you really like or don't like?
Well, in the beginning, when I started the podcast about 5 years ago, it was sort of that I wanted to talk about Survivor, but I also felt like I wanted to talk about the final season of Lost. So when I, you know, initially had the idea to talk about a podcast, it was like, you know, the idea of talking about a reality show, but also a scripted show. And the Survivor thing really took off a lot more than me talking about scripted shows, but it was also something that I wanted to do. I just find that for whatever reason, you know, I watch something and then I just want to talk about it. And I feel like TV show talk, to me, it's like, you know, 15, 20 years ago, you know, people would work in an office and there would be something on TV and then you'd go to work and you would, you know, talk about it around the water cooler talk. And now more and more people either don't have a job or, you know, are sort of like, you know, solopreneurs and sort of like have all these sort of like crazy work environments, whatever. So you really, and people are like, oh, don't tell me I DVR'd it. I don't talk about that.
Right.
So it's very hard for people to find discussion about the TV shows. So I just find it very, very natural. Whereas like on the reality side of things, it's more like talking about the strategy, but I feel like, you know, all of these scripted shows, I feel like have increasingly become more reality TV like, where, you know, a show like Game of Thrones, like you're not watching to see who's going to get voted out from Game of Thrones each week, but there's pretty much, you know, who's going to get whacked every week on Game of Thrones. And it's sort of like, you know, there's a lot to talk about. Oh my, right. You know,
But don't you think that reality TV has taken that from a scripted TV as opposed to scripted TV taking that from, I mean, if you look at Godfather 1 and Godfather 2 and Godfather, I mean, you know, I think that's sort of the genius of reality TV is that they figured out that people do this in real life, and we can just sort of replicate real life, and that I think, you know, especially Law and Order,
yeah,
are based on. It's sort of like the snake eating its own tail in a way, right? Like, so Law and Order is based on ripped from the headlines, and reality TV is based on ripped from the headlines, but also in some way, scripted television. So there's two genres stealing from, not stealing, but sort of leveraging off of real life, which
yeah,
is kind of.
You could look at it either way, where, you know, the appeal of the reality show is I tune into the reality show and I know at the end of the episode somebody is going home. I know that's the formula for what I'm going to see. Whereas right. scripted TV over the last, like, you know, 5 years or 10 years, the shows like The Walking Dead and the shows that sort of have like these high body counts where, or, you know, if it's not a death, it's like, you know, some sort of, you know, big fight scene or something. You know, there's a big climactic moment that happens on these scripted shows that I don't think if you went back 10 years ago, you would see nearly as much. And I think that from a programming point of view, you know, there's much more from a week to week, you know, what's sort of the big moment? What's the thing that people are going to be tweeting about in this episode? What's the hashtag? You know, who's going to get killed? So I feel like that scripted TV from episode to episode gets built a lot more about, you know, what is the big moment that's going to leave people talking about going into the next week, where shows like Mad Men came on and people are like, oh, this is going to be where it's going. But as Mad Men has continued to go on, you know, the pace of Mad Men has become, you know, a lot of people have checked out on Mad Men because it doesn't have those big pops on a week to week basis.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that reality television has changed the game for scripted television. It's sort of made scripted television sort of up their game, so to speak, in terms of entertainment value. You know, like I and some would argue that's for the worse and not better. Like that, you know, I'm sure if you took the creator of Mad Men, Matt Wiener,
yeah,
and pulled him aside, and I know this is a comic too, it's very analogous. Like, you can go up and kill with, like, really hacky, shitty material and destroy and, like, you right. know, have, be a puppet actor, whatever, you know, I don't know, whatever. Like, you know, pull floss out of your nose. I literally worked with a guy who did that. But is that kind of what you want you leave your legacy to be, right? Is that the way you want to do it? Or, you know, if you want to sort of have a season of Mad Men where you want some stuff to breathe and have it build to, like, one amazing crescendo instead of trying to do one every week. But, you know, you're competing with the reality shows that are, you know, giving you fireworks every week, like women flipping tables over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's an artistic choice. You know what I mean? And one could argue that, you know, the guy should stick to his guns and do what he wants, and hopefully the audience will continue to watch. Or he starts giving the audience what the audience thinks they want, which is, you know, more sensationalism. So, you know, I'm not saying all reality television is sensational. Some of it's really good and just as good, if not better, than scripted. But some of it, you know, like scripted television, there's, you know, there's good and there's bad. But I think it's an interesting sort of relationship between scripted television and reality television now, where they, I think, help each other in some way, but in other ways, sort of, they should be separate, and hopefully one doesn't get influenced by the other too much.
Yeah, yeah, there's a lot of merit in what you're saying. I feel like when you can sort of marry the two together, where you can tell like some epic story, you know, over, you know, 13 episodes for a number of seasons, but also, you know, get those big pops in there from a week to week basis. I feel like you have a show like Breaking Bad, which
yeah.
becomes like sort of like a universally, you know, loved show, as opposed to something that's like The Walking Dead, where it has a ton of pops, but not a great story, or Mad Men on the other side, which, you know, it's funny that these are three AMC shows. Yeah. Mad Men is on the other side, where it's like very few pops, but this, you know, sort of long, like novel-like story. So,
yeah,
you know, and the same is true with reality shows. There's reality shows that are done very well, and there's reality shows that are just, you know, a cash grab. So,
yeah, I mean, I think Survivor was done well. I think Amazing Race has always been good. I think Big Brother's been compelling, and I think, you know, you know, a lot of these, you know, food competitions, which I'll put in that category, are really interesting and compelling and just mesmerizing to watch at times. I mean, I don't, you know, I've never subscribed to it being like a shit genre at all. It's, you know, it's a mixed bag of stuff. There's plenty of scripted television that's just horrifically bad, you know?
Oh, sure. Sure.
And it's like weeding the, you know, but I think the good stuff, for the most part, survives, and unfortunately, sometimes it doesn't. I go to Arrested Development. I could never understand why that couldn't catch on with the country, but I just thought that was really, really funny. But you know, but there's, you know, one of the things that the programmers have to always remember, that you have to program not just to people on the West Coast and the East Coast, but to that big swath in the middle of the country. You know,
yeah, comedy. I feel like of the three different genres that we've talked about, you know, comedy and reality and drama. I feel like the serialized dramas are fine. You know, those are popping up everywhere. You know, the reality shows have, you know, held their own, but it's really the comedies and scripted comedy that is the thing that's really getting squeezed. I feel like that in the fall schedules that are coming out, you know, there's less and less scripted comedy. And I felt like there was like a sitcom boom for a couple of years, you know, sort of off of the success of The Big Bang Theory and How I Met Your Mother. But really there's, you know, fewer and fewer comedies on TV, because other than Big Bang Theory, those scripted comedy shows on the networks are just really struggling to find an audience.
Yeah, and they're expensive to produce. Although they're never going to have the audiences they had, you know, 10, 15 years ago, where they were shooting for 16 million people a night. They're happy to get 9 or 10 million, because the whole industry is so fragmented now with the web and everything else, that, you know, and the strength of cable and how good cable programming is, you know, I don't want to say it's better than network programming, but it's certainly, you know, there was a time when cable programming was viewed as, you know, the kid at the child at the Thanksgiving Day kids table, you know, not up to snuff with network television, but it's pushing beyond the quality of network television a lot of times. So it's really interesting. Listen, I want to thank you for having me, having been on my show.
You're welcome, Paul, anytime.
And having me on my show now. And we got to talk more, because I think, you know, there's a lot of fascinating stuff here about what's going on in TV, and like, we should check in from time and again just to kind of, you know, see, you know, anything, what's going on in the world of TV and what you think about it. And I think definitely people should be checking you out at, Rob has a podcast, and also Rob has a website.com, and they can, you've got several different podcasts going on and reviews, and he's like the Dick Clark of podcasting.
Yeah, we're doing a lot of shows. I probably do like, you know, three or four different podcasts a day talking about the reality stuff and the scripted stuff, but cool. I love to do it.
Well, we'll hook up when I come to L.A., and I'll come on and we'll shoot the shit. It'd be fun to come back, be on with you again. I had a really good time. We did the T.O. thing.
All right. Anytime, Paul. You tell me what you're watching, and we'll talk about it.
All right. Sounds good. All right, Rob. Thanks. Thanks for being on. And, guys, thanks for listening. And we'll see you next week.